From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the fall of 2007, Linda Bishop was discharged from a New Hampshire psychiatric facility. Linda had fought her sister's attempts to become her legal guardian, and she was refusing to take medication for her severe psychosis and bipolar disorder. But hospital workers had to let her walk away. They didn't tell anyone in her family, and a brutal New England winter was approaching. Linda wandered about 10 miles and managed to break into an abandoned farmhouse where she lived off rainwater and apples picked from a nearby orchard. And those are the basics for Jed and Todd Wider's documentary film about how Linda's mental illness made her a prisoner in that house and how she starved to death just a few hundred feet from help. Today in the program, we're profiling the film. It's called God Knows Where I Am. Join us after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When Linda Bishop happened upon an abandoned farmhouse in rural New Hampshire and was able to get in through an unlocked window, she says she felt free. There wasn't much in the house, an old mattress, some blankets and chairs. She found some notebooks among papers up in the attic, and she started a journal. Day one of my freedom, she would write. Day two of my freedom. Linda had spent about 3 years in a state psychiatric facility in New Hampshire, about 10 miles from the house. She suffered from severe bipolar disorder and psychosis. But Linda didn't escape from that facility. She was discharged, unconditionally discharged, despite the efforts of her sister to become her legal guardian and get her to take her medication. Linda always insisted nothing was wrong with her. So she walked out of the facility in October of 2007. And Linda settled into a routine in the farmhouse. She collected water from a brook, apples from a nearby orchard. But as the documentary filmmakers Todd and Jed Wider explore in their film, Linda became a prisoner in that house. She wasn't actually that far from the road or even from neighbors. She could have asked for help. She was a prisoner of her own mind. And when the apples ran out, she starved to death. Today in the program, we're talking about Linda's story. The Wider's film is called God Knows Where I Am, and it's an intimate study of Linda Bishop, but also of the system that failed her. We're screening the film next week. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. Jed and Todd Wider directed and co-directed the film. We're going to be screening it next Wednesday night. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Jed and Todd are joining us today from the studios of NPR in New York City. And Jed and Todd Wider, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
When did you first hear about Linda Bishop?
We had heard of the story originally, actually, from an article that had been written in the New Yorker by Rachel Aviv, who's a fantastic young writer. We at that point reached out to Joan Bishop, Linda's sister, who lived in New Hampshire, worked for the court system there, and Caitlin, Linda's daughter.
Yeah.
And we began a journey of developing a relationship with both of them.
Back up for just a sec. So I'm just trying to get who read the article first and what were you guys? I mean, I'm just trying to imagine your documentary filmmakers.
Yeah,
you come across this. It's a terrific piece. We'll put a link to it in our, our website. But who
actually,
finds it
an
and
interesting,
is like, wow, that may be a film or something.
Yeah, the original inspiration, this is Todd, the original inspiration for the topic came from an encounter I had with a homeless gentleman who had broken into the place I live in New York City. I came home one night in a cold February with two friends, and there this gentleman was sitting in my foyer wrapped around a radiator. And he told me he was simply just trying to get warm, that he was cold. I think the first words he said was, I'm sorry, I'm just cold, which was sort of heartbreaking, frankly. I got the police involved, and you know, we tried to help him. They asked if I wanted to press charges, and I didn't, but I made them promise that they would take him to a shelter. And then a couple blocks away, you know, at 2 in the morning or something, out as he was being driven off to the shelter, at a stoplight, the back door opened, and out he bounded into the snow and into the night and disappeared. A couple months later, he reappeared and sat in front of this building for what appeared to be, you know, 7 days and seven nights. I didn't watch him 24 hours a day, but every time I went in or out, he was there. Mm-hmm. And he was muttering and clearly psychotic and covered in his own urine, and he wasn't eating. So I began to call the police, and they would come and talk to him, and they left him there. And finally, after I had, I guess, called too many times, they sent the community rep. A very nice, actually, policewoman came and spoke to me and said, look, why do you keep calling us? You know, and I said, well, can't we have him taken to a hospital? He obviously needs medication, needs help, he needs care. And she said, well, this is not really a law enforcement problem. He is not harming himself. He's not at a risk of harming others. And I said, well, I think he is harming himself. He's obviously psychotic and he's not eating. And she said, well, we can't pick every homeless person up in New York City. It's not going to happen. It's not the mandate from the mayor and the government. And we can't do it. And this is a societal issue. It's not a law enforcement problem. And I have to say, you know, in retrospect, she's right. This is obviously not a law enforcement problem. Right. This is a whole societal issue. So in our city, which frankly is teeming with homeless people, many of whom are severely mentally ill, wandering all over New York City, perhaps the worst state of homelessness, at least in the time I've been there, and I've been there many decades mm-hmm. living there, it's something that we wanted to turn our sort of cinematic attention to explore the nature of civil liberties in the severely mentally ill and homeless. When do you medicate against someone's will? When do you institutionalize against someone's will?
Right, right.
So that was the original inspiration for the search for the story. And then I encountered the story in The New Yorker, as Jed had mentioned, in an article that Rachel had written, and that's where we began our journey. But our journey was sort of went in a different direction. It really went into a really more artistic, more cinematic, more intimate version of Linda, exploring what was going on inside her head, because we had those journals. Those were her own words that she had left behind. So that was the primary guide.
Yeah. I want to ask, so you could have done just kind of a conventional documentary talking about, you know, patients' rights, and but you mentioned the word cinematic. That's what's kind of original about this film, is it has, you said artistic too, and I think that's right, that it seems like for sure you take on the social issue of patients' rights, but it's almost in the background. What's in the foreground is the intimacy of Linda's life. It's just a telling of her 4 months in that farmhouse, and I'm wondering how you came upon that idea, how that, you know, how it evolved to the point where you decided that's what the film was going to be about.
Well, I think that there's sort of two answers to that. One is that at this moment in documentary filmmaking, when you try to make art, I think you have to have some, or at least you don't have to. One should try, I guess, to explore the relationship between content and form. And at this moment in the sort of evolution of documentary filmmaking, it seems often, not always, but often, many documentaries appear to be very content heavy, but honestly, sometimes a little bit form light. Mm-hmm. And this is our first directorial effort, Jed and I, and we wanted to do a sort of form heavy film too. And so our attention to the cinematic aspect of making the film was quite significant. The other issue, of course, is that Linda was a very visual person and was very visually cued into the world around her and very artistic. And I think that, you know, you make these films, you hope to touch people in a way, to perhaps bring attention to an issue, but also to reach an empathetic point with your viewer. You want your viewer to feel something. So I think that was really our primary goal.
You know, we had started out for close to about 8 months interviewing 20 of some of the leading psychiatrists in the country on the polemic issue of, you know, under what circumstances do we as a society have the right to forcibly treat a severely mentally ill patient against their will. And the more time that we spent with Joan and Caitlin, and then Joan actually turned over Linda's journals to us, mm-hmm. and the more time we spent with Linda's journals, the more we realized that, you know, we had Linda's own voice. And as Todd said, Linda was incredibly creative. She was an art history major. She was deeply intelligent. She was very insightful. You know, her observations in her journal as she sat in a rocking chair looking out a window were very poetic. You know, she speaks of a red robin landing on a lilac branch. She talks about astronomy. She talks about art. She talks about food. She was full of life. And so those observations and that personal story, which we had her story, we had her own words, really began to drive the approach that we wanted to take. And the story we wanted to take, the approach we wanted to take, was really to develop the interior landscape mm-hmm. of a woman who is severely mentally ill and homeless, and convey to the viewer what this woman thought, what she was thinking, what she saw, what she felt, what she heard during this four-month period of time, which was really one of the coldest winters on record in New Hampshire. That was really the beginning of the journey for us cinematically.
Let's play a moment from the film, because I want people to hear, in essence, Linda's voice as read by the actor Laurie Singer. I want to actually ask you, let's play this first, but I want to ask you about, you know, directing Laurie Singer and the role that she is playing. And in some ways, that's, I think, how at least I thought of it. But here's a sense of Linda Bishop's journal.
Sunday, October 7th, 8:15 a.m., Fenbrook phone. Finally feel caught up on my sleep. Nice and warm last night. Nice view from this chair to the west. And a chickadee on top of a lilac outside the window. The dining room windows have no locks, so really easy to step in. Water from the brook first. Found crab apples yesterday afternoon.
It's a great segment, I think, in the film to give people a sense of the pacing. You don't get the visuals, obviously, but it's so lyrical. Say something about that, the way you paced it, because this is the sense of at least this part of the film that people get, you know, throughout.
Look, you know, the pacing reflects the pacing with which Linda was living in those moments. Linda was unplugged, right? She had no iPhone. She had no electricity. She had no computer. There's no television.
Yeah.
What she had were her dreams, the words that she was writing in her diary, her delusions, and what she saw around her. So it was a reflection of the world in which she was living at that moment, an unplugged world, a non-electrified world. So to have paced the film like a music video or a more conventional documentary, fast-cutting it, was not, in our opinion, was not the right artistic choice. So that's why it's paced in a certain way. I mean, I think that, you know, we would love for people to see this in the theater, because we made it to be theatrically projected in a theater. The sound is all around you. Laurie's voice is mixed. Laurie is playing the role, as you said, of Linda Bishop. Laurie's voice is mixed in a certain way, a voice that descends essentially from the top of the theater, whereas the other interviews are more conventionally mixed to appear from the front. Mm. And you have this surround sound environment of sounds, of nature, of passing cars and other things, and her voice. And we wanted to create a sort of experiential documentary that actually put you in Linda's head inside that house with her. So that is why it's paced in the way it is. It's a journey. We want the audience to take this journey with us for the hour and a half that the film runs.
Yeah. What were the conversations like with Laurie? I mean, was it like conventionally, you know, directing a feature film in some ways?
I think, look, Laurie Singer is a seasoned, very well-established actress. She was the star of Footloose. She was in Shortcuts by Robert Altman. She's been in numerous films and television shows. And, you know, trained at Juilliard, and is really quite a talented actress, frankly. And she spent a lot of time, months, with the diary. She was given the actual diaries. At one point, she actually studied the imprinting of the pen on the paper of the actual diary.
Wow.
And then made notes to herself. This appears to be a more aggressive way that she's writing. She counted the letters and words on a particular line. Often these people do sort of free associate when they write, people that have this kind of illness.
Yeah.
So at certain moments, it would appear that Linda seemed more manic, so therefore she modulated the performance to echo what she thought was going on in her head, and she really does give a performance. It's certainly not a dry read. I mean, she really embodies the voice of Linda, so much so that, you know, we had eschewed the idea of listening to Linda in real life or even using real videotape of Linda if we could have found one. We didn't want that because we don't want Laurie to mimic Linda's voice.
Right.
We wanted Laurie to create her own characterization, her own character, so to speak. But when Joan first heard this, the sister, she remarked how startling it was that Laurie had somehow managed to nail the cadence with which Linda spoke from the diaries. So there was another point when Laurie actually, the initial recordings that she gave us were recorded. Laurie had managed to get access to a building in New York City that was being worked on that was, no one was living there. And she actually was going through some stuff and hadn't eaten in a couple of days and then purposely didn't eat. And then she sort of went into a closet and made these recordings inside a closet in this sort of semi-abandoned building. And those initial sets of recordings, I remember quite well. I mean, Jed can certainly speak on this too, but when Jed and I and Kiko Deguchi, the editor, who we think did a fantastic job, the three of us first heard those recordings, we all began to cry, actually. It was quite emotional. And this is after having listened to other actors and dry reads and trying all sorts of other ways to get the diary in a sort of powerful form on the screen. She just cracked it and nailed it. And it really does provide the ride that takes you through this. I mean, you are riding in Linda's head through this journey that she's on thanks to her performance.
Can I play another moment from that while you're
sure.
talking about this? Because I want to hear Laurie doing Linda Bishop again. I don't think much more to say. It just gives you a sense of another kind of dramatic, kind of lovely moment.
I do have a lot to be thankful for. I'm safe, which is a big thing. I'm comfortable and warm. And I'm dry and I have food, even though only apples. Still planning on going out for apples, but I don't want to chance it in the daylight. Helicopter over the barn. It's going up South 132 fast. But it's not like it's looking for someone. I'm not planning on going anywhere today. It only got up to the low 60s. It's 2 p.m. and I'm hiding in an attic, just like so many had to hide in Nazi Germany.
From the film God Knows Where I Am, we have Jed Wider and his brother Todd with us. They directed the film next Wednesday night. That's April 12th. We're going to be screening it at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Jed and Todd are going to be there for a Q&A after the film. You can get details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the story of Linda Bishop, a bright and funny woman diagnosed with severe mental illness. Linda starved to death in an abandoned New Hampshire farmhouse after she was discharged from a state psychiatric facility. The filmmakers Jed and Todd Wider draw from the journal that Linda kept as she died. Their documentary is this touching portrait of her life and also a study of how the system failed her. We're screening the film next week, talking about it today. I want to ask you Jed and Todd Weider about nature. The farm itself is really a powerful metaphor, because there was such. It's interesting. It's almost a metaphor for Linda's life in some way. She has an affection for nature, for gardening, and then things go wrong with her life. The farm was once vibrant. It had, you know, it was the gathering place in the area, and now it's decrepit and you know, abandoned. Would you just talk about that as an element?
Sure, that's a really good observation. The farmhouse itself is an historic farmhouse. It's been there for well over 100 years, and the farmhouse in many ways becomes a character, just like Linda. The farmhouse had been filled with life at one point, filled with laughter of children. Linda had spent much of her youth working on farms, and you know, in an ulterior, in an alternative universe, you know, when Linda first came to this farmhouse after being released from the hospital, she might have looked at this farmhouse as her Eden. Mm-hmm. Her sister said that, you know, this is the type of place that she perhaps would have been very happy living in. You know, unfortunately, when she arrives at the farmhouse, it's in the fall, but the colors are vibrant, and she comes to this house, and this house for her is sort of like an Eden. It's a sanctuary. Right. She's been released from a state psychiatric hospital where she was not happy. She didn't want to be treated. She arrives there. The autumn leaves are full of color. She breaks into the house, and she finds great freedom there. Unfortunately, as the fall drags on and winter begins to set in, the colors begin to shift from vibrant colors to grays and very dark colors. The sounds begin to change. We begin to see the house in a very different way. Mm-hmm. And as Linda's apple supply begins to diminish, you begin to see elements of the house that really mirror, in a metaphorical sense, Linda's own journey downwards. The wallpaper begins to peel off the walls. You begin to see more of the cracks in the floorboards. You hear the wind coming through the broken caulking in the window itself. And as a result of that, as Linda runs out of her apple supply and her situation becomes incredibly dire, you also see the house dying around her as she is dying within the house.
Can I ask, was that the actual house that you shot for the film?
Yes, that is the actual farmhouse where Linda lived for 4 months. We shot there for almost a full 2-year period, almost over a complete 8 seasons. Mm. We shot there in the dead of winter. There's no electricity in that house. In fact, there were many days where we shot in that house where the temperature was sub-zero.
I was going to ask about that. So you had a sense of this is what her life was like.
Yes. Yeah, the winter shots there were extremely difficult. Mm. We had a generator outside. We were, you know, attempting to keep, you know, the room, a particular room where we were shooting, heated. It was a difficult situation, but you know, there was a religious element to shooting there. I mean, this was a place where a woman had died very tragically, and you know, so there was a great deal of respect, I think, accorded by everyone working on that film to the site where we were. But we did shoot all of the interiors, the exteriors, everything was shot there in the house, along with the sounds that we captured as well. Because the sound landscape, yeah, you know, as Todd mentioned, is critically important. And we'd wanted to create an experiential type of documentary. We wanted you to hear what it was that we believed Linda would have heard sitting inside that house. You know, the cars in the distance from the highway in the back of the property, the cars from the front of the property, just, you know, 100 feet from the front door of the property, the street runs by the house. Mm. You know, the wind coming through you know, coming through the window. You know, the wind in the film is really a metaphor for madness.
Right.
We wanted you to hear that, and we wanted you to see what Linda would have seen. So, you know, sitting inside, you know, what was it like for this, you know, mentally ill homeless woman sitting inside an abandoned farmhouse in the middle of night by herself with no electricity, just in pure darkness? What does that feel like, you know, to us as a viewer? You know, that became part of the visual approach that we took with respect to the film, but also, as Todd went into, part of the sound landscape that we wanted to create with the film, too.
That sense of darkness as winter approaches and as the season shifts, that was a really powerful, I think, visual element. And it's one of the people in the film talks about the fact that, you know, New Hampshire winters, there's not a lot of daylight going on. And so you're just trying to imagine her mostly existing because there was no electricity. She was in the dark most of that time.
Right, right. I mean, we really tried to portray the frailty of the human condition, and it's also the condition of nature as well.
Yeah.
I mean, we see Linda there, who arrives happy, with great expectations, and goes out foraging for apples from the apple orchard in the backyard of the property. She's out there collecting water from the brook that runs through the property itself. You know, but all of those colors begin to fade over time. And those apples that looked, you know, filled with sort of rich reds and rich greens, you know, begin to decay as winter sets in. And so color and light become very critical to the color palette that we decided to focus on with respect to the film and the transformation of that palette.
I want to ask you a little bit more about that, because I've read where you've been talking about this, where you have the painter Magritte, for example, and Andrew Wyeth, and I think this is interesting, the palette for the images that we see. And in some ways you're inspired, at least maybe I may have this wrong, but Linda's own artistic sensibilities. I mean, she was an art history major herself.
Yes, I mean, that certainly played into it, you know, the desire to evoke the images that she actually herself references in the diary. She actually speaks at one point of a Winslow Homer painting.
Right.
And she quotes a William Carlos Williams poem at one point, both of which we attempted to show in the film as well. The palette and the sort of color we chose were influenced by many things. You know, one of the painters that we were looking at actually was a Danish painter by the name of Hammershøi, who paints these very beautiful, sort of bucolic but somewhat disturbing scenes. Another, of course, in a way, Magritte related in the idea of the representation of the apple as a surreal element.
Right, right, right.
But the palette is more along the lines of Wyeth or Hammershøi. We also looked at films by people like Terrence Malick, who, of course, is particularly adept, we feel, at attempting to portray consciousness, the state of consciousness, and also works by filmmakers like Tarkovsky. I think his palette, the way that he would show the absence of things, he would film empty rooms, he would show the absence of things, you would look at a room and think that there's no life in here, the life has been taken out and whatnot, and the way the camera sort of would float through rooms and whatnot. There was a lot of references. Both of us had studied, had spent a lot of time focusing on the history of film and filmmaking and art as well. And, you know, we've been wanting to direct a film for a long time. So I think there's a lot of influences that we brought to the screen, as well as our very talented cinematographer, Gerardo Puglia, who had trained with people like Vittorio Storaro and Haskell Wexler and Gordon Willis. So he brought his own, you know, Roger Deakins is another one that influenced him greatly, who he knew. So he brought his own sensibilities as well, which is part of the reason that we chose at different points to use really, frankly, somewhat less traditional
filmmaking formats.
Techniques to make this. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to ask you about that, because there was there's this section. It occurs from time to time where Linda obviously is thinking a lot about food. Now, she's a decent cook. when she was of sound mind with her and with her daughter. So she knows decent food. And so she's thinking about this. But the food that we see, because there's these kind of recreations of this food. And I want to ask you about the film format, because I've heard you or somebody describe it as kind of like a commercial memory.
Yes.
Like food commercials from the 60s or something.
Yes, that's right. We were going for that. We, you know, as we said, Linda was unplugged in that house, right? She was she was really no longer part of the world of modernity in which the rest of us inhabit. So she was living in a way in the world of the past, which included the imagery of the past. So clearly when a person is becoming more and more hungry and starving, they begin to perseverate about food and dream about food. And the diary becomes increasingly littered with menus and recipes of meals that she would like to cook. So we actually endeavored to cook every single recipe and menu in that entire diary.
Wow.
So we cooked, you know, 40 meals or something, like an enormous number of meals. And these are these strange concoctions that, you know, she had in her head.
Yeah.
Some were not, but some, you know, different ways of mixing food is very interesting. And we cooked, as she said, you know, as she wrote the recipe, we cooked it. But we wanted to show that to you in a format that seemed appropriate. She had access to old Good Housekeeping magazines in the attic from 30 or 40 years ago that were, you know, part of garbage that was left there. And she, of course, had access to her memories. So we didn't feel that shooting those food segments in digital video was appropriate, because there was an immediacy of digital video which didn't seem right. It almost seems hyper-real. So instead, we chose for those shots actually Super 16, which has a real patina of nostalgia. So it does feel, I mean, we were certainly going for creating these sort of commercial memory type elements of food, where you look at this and you think, my God, that's an advertisement from 1970 for Thanksgiving dinner, you know? Mm-hmm. And it has this sense of nostalgia to it. Those shots were predominantly lit naturally with candlelight or sunlight or you know, whatever light we could get predominantly. And so there is this real patina of nostalgia there. The other thing, of course, that we were looking at was Babette's Feast,
right,
which is a film that portrays meals and food. And, you know, I have to say, I think both of us agree that upon leaving the theater from originally seeing that film way back when, and if your viewers haven't seen it, it's a great film to look at. But you watch that film and you really get hungry, actually. Right. At least I think we both felt that. You felt hungry. You feel hunger from watching that film. So in a way, we've been told by people that have seen this film that they do feel hungry when they see those food shots. And that goes back to our original attempts to try to make this a more experiential documentary.
Yeah. I felt hungry and cold. Really cold. A lot,
good,
actually. I want to play another moment. This is, again, Laurie Singer reading from Linda's journal. And, of course, Linda does not, and how could you, factor in the fact that this winter was going to be, as you said, you know, a really bad winter. And so we're going to hear her referring to going down to the brook, as you'll hear. But you'll also hear her reference Kate. Kate is Caitlin, her daughter. Let me play this, and then I want to talk about the role of her daughter in all of this.
I've been up since 4 a.m. After eating my fourth apple, I'm heading down to the brook to wash. But the water is so cold. There are no indications that I should be doing anything other than what I have been. They seem to be no longer looking for me in this area. I'm worried about Kate. I had a dream where she was yelling for me.
Now, we should mention that this is, I think, isn't this the only reference in the all of the 4 months of the journals that she refers to her daughter?
Yes, that's right.
Caitlin Murtaugh, who's featured in the film, knows that. Let's start with Caitlin and the role that she plays. When did you approach her, and what did you say to Caitlin that you wanted to talk to her about, and what, you know, how you described the film for her?
Sure. I mean, it was very important from the outset that that both Joan and Caitlin Understood the approach that we wanted to take with respect to this film. You know, we wanted to create a film that told the story of Caitlin's mother,
yeah.
Joan's sister, and conveyed the tragedy of it, the horror of the circumstances, and how a woman could have fallen through the cracks of a broken mental health care system and a system that perceives to take care of our homeless, but in many instances does not succeed. But also to use the story as a window into some of the larger issues that our country faces with respect to how we address important issues associated with the severely mentally ill and the homeless. And so it was critically important that they understood that. It was important that they felt vested in this process because this is a long journey. I mean, this film took us almost 4 years to make. And, you know, typically, you know, we are driven by socio-political topics. You know, Todd and I have been producing documentary films for almost 17 years now and have produced over that period of time almost the same number of documentaries. You know, since this was the first film that we decided to direct, we wanted to make sure that they were fully vested in this process and fully on board. And they were. And we spent a significant amount of time with both of them, informing them as to the approach we were taking, the interviews that we were looking to do. They very, very willingly participated in this.
Yeah.
They wanted to see, I think, both of them very clearly something positive to come out of this, not only to bring the story and the tragedy of their loved one to the greater public, but also attempt to affect in any way change, either change to law or change to the way we as a society view the mentally ill and also the homeless, and perhaps inspire others to, you know, rather than just step over these people as they walk down the street, as, you know, many of us have been conditioned to doing, perhaps looking at these people in a very different way, or reaching out your own hand to attempt to help them in even a small way. So that was really the approach that we took with respect to both Caitlin and Joan.
Here's another moment. You'll hear Caitlin Murtaugh in this clip. Also Joan Bishop, that's Linda's sister.
Going from, you know, the kid whose mother is, you are my daughter, I protect you, you are my life, to the daughter whose second, third, and fourth thought in their mind. Yeah. Considering how close they were and how much she felt about Caitlin, the fact that she really didn't talk about her a lot in that diary, I think was kind of significant. And I think it was, I'm just going to block that out because it's too painful.
Two things I noticed in that clip and another, a later moment with Joan. How much is expressed without them saying anything? Like, Caitlin is clearly pained by the fact that her mother says virtually nothing about her in those in that diary. And we should point out, Linda abandons her daughter when she's 13 years old. She, in fact, the story plays out in the documentary. She has she wakes up and there's a note from her mom which says, "I've gone to see the governor. Go over to the neighbors," and it's the last she sees from her for a while. But Caitlin, as you sort of heard there, and then Joan later, we just see them expressing a reaction as opposed to hear them saying it. I don't know. Maybe it's just something that I noticed. But could you say something about that?
Yeah, I think that's a good pickup. That's something that Jed and I are very interested in looking at, actually, and have explored certainly in this film. There is, you know, there is power in silence and the absence of words. And you can see very, very interesting and sort of perceptive things, the way people react and how they look at you and how they look at the camera, how they sort of look away in thought, and you can see them overcome with emotion. And, you know, we try to approach the truth in documentary filmmaking, I think as a sort of basic tenet, we try to approach the truth. Mm. Of course, it's a subjective truth because these films are edited and we have edited this film the way we want people to see it. So by its very nature, by the editorial and the process and the production process as well, look, we are in a way sort of shaping a truth here. Mm. But much like a film like Rashomon that unfolds in the beginning, which is similar in a way, certainly sort of in a way that our film unfolds, where you have different angles of, you know, a body is found in a house. How did it get there?
Right.
First you hear the passerby, then you hear the policeman, then you hear the medical examiner, then the senior medical examiner. Then you begin to hear other things. And finally you hear Linda's own voice embodied by Laurie Singer. And these are all different facets and different approaches to what the truth is. But we can only approximate the truth. You know, we will never know what Linda Bishop exactly did or felt in that house, but we have a very close record of it in her diary. But again, that is her own subjective truth. Mm. And I think that you do approach the truth in moments when you're speaking with people by just watching the way that they react to you or react to a question and perhaps don't answer a question or stop in silence. We never turn the camera off in an interview.
Yeah.
We always let it run. And you capture beautiful moments that are very poetic and very powerful, frankly, when the person has not been asked a question, when they're sitting in their chair thinking about what they were talking about minutes before. And it is a way of unlocking the soul, so to speak. Another interesting thing we did here is that the people that found Linda's body in death, the policeman, the medical examiner, were interviewed in the room that they had last seen her in, which is the room that she had died in. So the policeman and the medical examiner did their interviews in the very living room that Linda Bishop had died. Wow. That's where we filmed those interviews. And they had not been back to that building since. They had last seen her there. And that had a tremendous, frankly, I think a tremendous emotional impact on them and helped us to unlock the stories from their perspective. So I do think that there is truth in silence as well in noise. And silence was an important part of this story because Linda was very much alone in that house. Yeah. in her head.
Right. The film is God Knows Where I Am. Todd Weider and Jed Weider directed the documentary, which you can see next Wednesday night. That's April 12th. We're screening it at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with Utah Film Center. Todd and Jed are both going to be there for a Q&A after the film. You can get details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another quick break and come back for some final thoughts. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with the filmmakers Todd and Jed Weider. We're talking about their documentary, God Knows Where I Am, which we're screening next Wednesday. That's April 12th. They'll be with us at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. They're joining us now to talk about the film. I want to ask you, do you have a sense, after this 4 years now you spent on this project, did Linda Bishop have a plan in mind? Do you think she just got trapped in that place in many ways? Do you feel like you know, not know her, but have a sense of her in a better way?
I think she arrived, I think as I said a little before, I think she arrived at the farmhouse thinking that this would be a beautiful place to be. She arrived at a particular time seasonally. She went out to look for food. She had plenty of apples. She collected hundreds of apples. She had a water supply. She found books to read. She found magazines to read. She would go out at night looking for more food. But I think that, if you read the journals are littered with these very creative, artistic, and very poetic passages. But as time goes on, and the food supply begins to diminish, you see more and more passages where Linda really does not have or appear to have great lucidity or great clarity.
Yeah.
And her mental illness really begins to seep in to her written word and clearly what she's experiencing and what she's thinking about at that time.
And she gets really religious, right?
Linda in life outside of the house was actually an atheist. But inside the farmhouse, as her situation becomes more dire and dire, she becomes very deeply religious. You know, she's referencing Jesus. She's referencing the Ascension. She's citing Psalms. She speaks about Steve, an individual who she thinks is coming to rescue her.
Right.
But in reality, over time, you begin to see this character of Steve actually begin to morph with Jesus and her own salvation.
Right.
So there's a whole religious component to her journey at the end. I think we have a general feel for who she was, I think, based upon conversations and pretty deep conversations that we've had with, you know, those people that knew her best. But that character is only part of it.
Yeah.
You know, and as Caitlin says, you know, I loved my mother, you know, but I hated Linda Bishop. There is that sort of twisted dark side to Linda, which is her mental illness.
Yeah.
And I think it's difficult to really fully understand Linda, especially as she begins to descend into greater darkness, into her mental illness, as you know, the final months continue to unravel. You know, what we do know of her was that she was full of life. She was an intelligent person. She was a wonderful mother. She loved her daughter. She was extremely close to her parents. She went down to Florida to take care of her own father.
Right.
And actually at that point was on medication, went off of her medication. She functioned very well on medication.
Right.
She went off of the medication because she feared that if her father called out, she wouldn't be able to hear him and take care of him. And that, you know, unfortunately for Linda, you know, was one of those pivotal moments where things began to unravel, unfortunately for
yeah.
her.
Here's one final moment from the film, God Knows Where I Am.
I'm doing the best I can. I'm doing the best I can to maintain. But I don't have a lot of strength. I had a headache, and I had a stomach ache, and this starving, this is very painful. If I stay here, I will die. And my survival is proof of my sanity. That's important. And so my plan is to go to family in transition in Manchester for food, shower, laundry. However, it's Friday, so it's a matter of surviving till Monday.
What was the reaction of Caitlin and Joan and the family of Linda Bishop?
I think Joan was very pleased with the result. You know, Caitlin was happy with the result as well. You know, I think we all there's a human sort of instinct to seek meaning in tragic deaths. You know, and this certainly was a tragic death. So for Joan and Caitlin, and frankly for us as filmmakers, we have sought and I believe found meaning in this death. In a way, as a reflection on the failings of our society and the sort of ever poorer social service safety net that's meant to catch people like Linda Bishop. And, you know, make no mistake, there are thousands of Linda Bishops or more all over our country that need help and that are quite vulnerable. And they all have souls that are worthy and humanity that should be honored and preserved. And I think at its heart, that is why we made this film.
Yeah. I thought it was so interesting. There's the moment in the film when you talk about the rights of patients. And, you know, Joan talks about this. When you're not of clear mind, can you, should you be able to make decisions about yourself? And, you know, this question of freedom comes up. And then this idea of the fact that I can't remember the statistic exactly, but I think it's 1.6 million people who have, for example, I think it was schizophrenia was the statistic that comes up, and yet half of those people have no awareness, no
yes.
insight, which is kind of the loaded term, that they're sick. Say something about that, if you would, finally.
Well, I think that, you know, the question, of course, arises whether she freely chose this death,
yeah.
this journey she clearly chose. Did she freely choose the death, this way of exiting reality in a way. And one would question, if the mind is not free, can someone really exercise free will? The motto of the state of New Hampshire is live free or die.
Right.
But Linda Bishop, despite what it might seem, did not live freely. She was imprisoned in that house. She was imprisoned within her own mind and inevitably then within the actual physical structure of the surroundings when the snow piled up too high and she was too weak to simply just open the door and leave, because for months all she had to do was simply open the door and literally walk across the street and she would actually have been saved. And would have been able to find help by numerous next-door neighbors said, of course, they would have helped her and immediately gotten help if they had only known she was there. One of the most tragic parts of the film, of course, is when you learn that her sister drove back in front of the building that her sister was starving in almost every day on her way to work, and it could have simply just stopped and picked her up and taken her back to the hospital. So, yes, she was free. Initially, she was free. She had found Eden. But again, her mind was not free. It was obtunded. It was intermittently delusional. And she was impaired. And as a result of that, she was vulnerable. And that is why she sort of found the fate that she did.
The film is God Knows Where I Am, which you can see next Wednesday night. That's April 12th at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. Todd and Jed White are going to be there for a Q&A after the film. You can get details about that on our website, radiowest.org. Todd and Jed White are joined us today from NPR Studios in New York City. Thanks, guys, very much. We'll look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction today from Adrian Moranville. David Boyle is our intern. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.